maintenant, j'ai le plaisir d'inviter à la tribune Peter van den Dungen, qui va nous faire traverser l'Atlantique et la Manche, nous parler de Florence Nightingale versus Clara Barton, éco-discordant en Angleterre et aux États-Unis. Peter est un historien de la paix. Il donne des cours de littérature classique de la paix et donc aura le plaisir de s'écarter un peu de ce qu'il fait au quotidien à l'Université de Bradford en tant que Visiting Lecturer in Peace Studies. Will you make it in English or in French?
English.
Ok. Donc la présentation se fera en anglais. That's a great privilege to get you today. I understand you don't have PowerPoint.
No.
So you have the floor.
Thank you. Good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen. It is a pleasure and a privilege to be here again. And I'd like to thank Roger Durand and his team for yet organizing yet again, I think, a wonderful symposium with wonderful publications. I apologize for speaking in English, but since my subject is the reception of the memory of Solferino in the English-speaking world, maybe that's a good enough reason. It also means that you don't have to suffer my poor French. I would like to, first of all, make a few sort of preliminary observations, which is I have been interested in memory of Solferino for a long time, as part of my interest in the critical works in Western civilization concerning world peace. So I have been teaching courses on this subject, starting with Erasmus, 1500. And when we come to the 19th century, of course we come to memory of Solferino. And it was already mentioned yesterday why it is such an important work, because this book led to the Red Cross and the Geneva Conventions, and the rest is history. So there are very few works, I think, in that field which have had this immediate impact. I would just like to point out two more works, which maybe not quite the same, but which also have had a very interesting impact. And they relate to some extent to Henri Dunant. So the first one is a book which was published 24, 25 years later, and that is the book by the Baroness Bertha von Suttner, Lay Down Your Arms, Die Waffen Nieder, A Bas les Armes, 1889. So that book had a profound impact on herself, just as Memory of Solferino had on Dunant. It changed their lives. And Bertha von Suttner became one of the great leaders of the European peace movement until she died just before the war in June 1914. But also, one can say that a consequence of the publication of her book, which was also an immediate bestseller and translated into many languages, was the foundation of the Nobel Peace Prize. Because Bertha von Suttner had been for 1 week Nobel secretary, they kept in touch after her book, Nobel congratulated her, and Bertha von Suttner made it clear that working for peace needs money, and there was no money. So when he died, 1896, in his will, the Nobel Peace Prize was there. And she was, you know, it was meant for her. The first prize should have been for her in 1901, but it went to Henri Dunant and Frédéric Passy. And the poor woman had to wait until 1905 before she got the prize. My friend Leo van Berge has written a good article about Bertha von Suttner and Henri Dunant, but I think there is scope for a book about their relations. And when Dunant got the prize, Bertha von Suttner was not too happy. So there's a whole story there which we can't deal with now. So that is one thing. As I say, a very important bestseller, which also brought about very interesting consequences. Then, about 10 years later, we have another forgotten work, which is again very different from Bertha von Suttner's novel, which is a book, I think I mentioned it here maybe 2 years ago, by Jean de Bloch, the Polish-Russian industrialist banker who in 1898 published a work in 6 volumes, first in Russian and then in Polish and translated into French and German, A work entitled War, The War of the Future, and the Future of War, and Bloch came to the conclusion that there should not be another war, because another war between the great powers of Europe would be unlike any other war of the past. And he says somewhere, if I was in charge of military academies, the first thing I would do was to remove all existing literature on war, because it is out of date. And I think an interesting study remains to be written about Jean de Bloch's treatment of Dunant, because he says, he refers to Memory of Solferino and what Dunant has done, and he says in a future war, the Red Cross, it won't be of any consequence. There will be such, the casualties will be such, so enormous, it will overpower the work of the Red Cross. As I say, I think this needs to be researched and written about, because to my knowledge, there is no study about Dunant and Jean de Bloch. And Jean de Bloch is totally forgotten, and I'm hoping in a few years, when we are commemorating the centenary of the First World War, that at least his time will come, that, and that people will discover that there was somebody, more than anybody else, who foresaw what that war would be like. And in his, he moved heaven and earth to tell his contemporaries there should be no more war. And in order to convey this message to a large public, he opened a pioneering institution in Lucerne, in the center of Switzerland, which was the first museum of peace, which was opened in 1902. Unfortunately, Bloch had died a few months before of a heart attack. And this museum, unfortunately, was not able to prevent the war. And after the war, it closed down. But for me, this is sacred ground. There is no other place in the world where such an effort was made, an educational effort, to tell people, look, if there's going to be another war, it will be a total catastrophe. Now, what was the consequences of Jean de Bloch's book? He was a confidant of Tsar Nicholas II. It is no surprise that Bloch's book was published in the summer of 1898, at the same time that the Tsar's rescript was issued, calling for a peace conference, which took place in 1899 in The Hague, the first Hague Peace Conference, a very important peace conference, which led to the creation of the first permanent institution for peaceful conflict resolution, the Permanent Court of Arbitration, which still exists in The Hague. 1907, the second Hague Peace Conference, the Hague Conventions on the Laws of War, building on the Geneva Convention, and so on. And 1907, during the Second Hague Peace Conference, the first stone was laid for a building to give the Permanent Court of Arbitration a new home. And this became the Peace Palace, which was opened in 1913, and next year we have the centenary of the Peace Palace, which is now the home of the International Court of Justice of the United Nations. So this book by Jean de Bloch, one may say, brought about the first Hague Peace Conference, the second Hague Peace Conference, the Permanent Court of Arbitration, and there were plans for a third Hague Peace Conference in 1915. And this development was interrupted by the war. So as I say, in the history, when one looks at the history of peace of the last 500 years, we have, at least a dozen great classics. And for some of them, certainly in the 19th century, Dunant, Bertrand Soutner, Jean de Bloch, we can say these books made a great difference in one way or another. So that is one preliminary observation I wanted to make. Then I want to like to say something about Dunant and England, or Dunant and the English-speaking world, but let us confine ourselves to Dunant and England. And to my knowledge, and I'm not an expert as regards Dunant, there is no single volume which looks at Dunant's connections with England. And as we know, he has been there several times, sometimes for prolonged periods. He spoke English, he wrote English. And here is scope, I think, for a wonderful kind of doctoral thesis, Dunant and England. And I can see one way of structuring such a thesis would be focusing on individuals. Florence Nightingale, Charles Dickens, and he will be the subject of my talk in a moment. Thomas Longmore, the English representative to the conferences in 1863 and 1864. And also, very interestingly, the longtime president of the English Peace Society, Henry Richard, a wonderful man, totally forgotten, also in England, who for 40 years, from about 1840 till 1880, was president of the Peace Society. A great figure, parliamentarian, a wonderful figure. Now, if you look at the standard history of the English peace movement by Martin Kiedel from Oxford, you know, two volumes, Dunant is not mentioned. But Dunant was employed by Henry Richard, employed with payment, as a secretary. And he published in the Herald of Peace, the journal of the Peace Society. But as I say, this is ignored, this is not known. So this would be one way of approaching the subject, Henri Dunant and England, via some great figures. Another approach would be to do it thematically. What about the movement for the signing of the Geneva Convention, for the creation of the British Red Cross Society, and the involvement of Henri Dunant in England? We know in the 1870s, 72, 73, Dunant by this time was very much involved in promoting a convention for the prisoners of war. He was very much involved. By this time also he had discovered arbitration, you know, the Alabama Tribunal at that time. So we can also look at Henri Dunant and those various causes and what he did in England to promote those causes. So as I say, here is scope, I think, for a very interesting and original study, Henri Dunant and England. And I must say, anybody who is interested in Henri Dunant and the Red Cross and who does not live in or near Geneva is very much disadvantaged in at least two ways, I would say. First of all the important archives are, of course, here in the University and Public Library in the ICRC. That is one thing. And secondly, I would say such a person is also very much disadvantaged because you are not near to Roger Durand, who I think is a walking encyclopedia about anything to do with Henri Dunant. And I would say to Roger, as far as I can tell, it is a very long time, not in my memory, since there was a study trip to England in the traces of Henri Dunant. You have had such a... I see. But so far, it has not resulted in any memorial plaques, of which there will be many. So may I suggest that maybe in the future, this could be I think a worthwhile visit. And I would like to assist you somehow to identify some places of significance in this this context. So when we talk about Henri Dunant and England and the reception of his book in England, when Roger suggested the title, I said that is fine. Let us make a comparative study between England, which is Florence Nightingale, and the United States, which is Clara Barton. But for many years, I have been puzzled about one thing, which is clearly revealed in this book. So here we have 1862, first edition. Here we have the first full text in English, an American edition, 1939, more than 75 years later. Now, in all the biographies of Dunant, we read... it was a bestseller, immediately translated into all sorts of languages, which is true, as we know, in the next year, 1863, it translated into German, into Dutch, into Italian. What about English? 1939. How is that possible? What happened here? So one thing which happened here, I think, is very much associated with the name of Florence Nightingale. Because, of course, in England, 1854, 1856, the war in the Crimea. And Florence Nightingale, the story is well known. And she is, I think, one can draw very interesting parallels between Florence Nightingale and Henri Dunant in terms of their social background and so on, their Christian beliefs, and also this inspiration coming from God, an explicit kind of... it was very interesting. Now, as we also know, Florence Nightingale was not very much in favor with what Dunant suggested. Government is the responsibility of governments to look after the wounded on the field of battle. And if this responsibility is taken away from governments, she says they will have even more money to fight wars. So, out of the Crimean War, there were terrific improvements in England as regards the army medical service, a terrific improvement, but more generally as regards hospitals and the profession of nursing. Because at this time, nurses were the lowest of the low. This profession had no standing. Nightingale's family were very much against her choosing this profession, because this was not in accordance with her social position. She single-handedly really made nursing a profession and a respected profession. So there is no doubt about her great importance. In terms of writings, Henri Dunant's little book of Memory of Solferino can be compared with one or two of Florence Nightingale's 800-page writings with her proposals, which immediately found favor with the government and so on, and she had very good contacts. So when Henri Dunant's book was published, to some extent, to a large extent maybe, people in England could say, that's an old story, we have already, this is, you know, we can't learn anything much. We have drawn consequences from the disasters in the Crimea, and the results are there. So that is, I think, one explanation. But I must say I was astonished when I consulted for this colloquium the most recent biography of Florence Nightingale by Mark Bostrich, which was published in 2008, a work of 650 pages. It is entitled Florence Nightingale, The Making of an Icon. So I looked at a very extensive index at the end, at the back, no mention of Dunant, no mention of the Red Cross, no mention of Solferino. And this book is considered to be the best biography now of Florence Nightingale, the first major biography in 50 years. And Dunant is not mentioned at all. Is this possible? Because we know the context between Florence Nightingale and Dunant. At the time of the publication of Solferino, but also several years later, and she invited him to stay with her, which he could not do, for we do not know exactly why not, and so on. And she supported him when he was talking about the Convention for Prisoners of War and so on. So certainly, one would have thought there is sufficient material for a biographer to have at least some references to Dunant in the life of Florence Nightingale. So when I then started sort of reading the book, and I did not have much time, 650 pages, in the footnote is a reference to Florence Nightingale, in the footnote. And this is an interesting story, because the author looks at the posthumous reputation of Florence Nightingale. And the author discovers, or mentions, that in 1915, there was a film about Florence Nightingale, a documentary. And of course, it was a silent film. And so in between the images, you have a little bit of text. And at a certain moment, it says, Florence Nightingale, the founder of the Red Cross. And then there is a footnote at the back of the book, and it says, the filmmaker was wrong. The founder of the Red Cross is a Swiss businessman called Henri Dunant. End of story. End of story. That is all this big biography of Florence Nightingale has to say about Henri Dunant. Amazing. Amazing. Now, my subject is, and I summarize it very quickly, and this is maybe also another explanation why we had to wait so long to have a full translation of Memory of Solferino in English. My subject is Charles Dickens. And I think it's very right to talk about Charles Dickens, because this year is the bicentenary of the birth of Charles Dickens, 1812. 1812. And my goodness, what a towering figure also is Charles Dickens. I mean, there is Nightingale, but there's also Dickens. What a phenomenon. What a phenomenon. And I'm not a Dickens specialist. But I have now discovered in preparing these papers that there is a whole Dickens industry. Not just now, because of the bicentenary, but generally. And one of the projects which has been taking place for 5 years or so at the University of Buckingham, which is the only university in England which is private, and which was founded during the days of Mrs. Thatcher. At the University of Buckingham, there is a very interesting project which will run for years to come, which is an analysis of Dickens's weekly journal. As you know, Dickens had a weekly journal, which was called All the Year Round, a weekly journal, in which his novels appeared in weekly installments, Great Expectations, and so on. So this was a very popular journal. And I have seen different estimates of the circulation. According to Dickens' secretary, a man called Wills, the average circulation was 100,000 copies. But sometimes, at Christmas time, this would rise to 300,000 copies. And a recent biographer says the average circulation was 250,000 copies. And people, when the new issue came out, you know, people were very hungry to buy it because of his novels. But also, there were little articles about politics and so on. And it was in this journal, All the Year Round, that an extract was published of Memory of Solferino in May of 1863. A long extract. This journal is available on the web. And as I say, this journal was extremely important. And in this journal was published a long extract of Memory of Solferino. In my estimation, the extract is about one-third of the book. One-third of the book. And it follows the book. And I have made a sort of an analysis. What is in there, what is not in there. And the things which have been not included are maybe less interesting. One of the famous phrases in Memory of Solferino, tutti fratelli, is not in the extract. Not in the extract. So, this extract is in four parts, eight pages, double columns. And I have the. And then later on in August, there was a second article, which was about sort of an update about Memory of Solferino. And it refers to a fourth edition coming out, 1863. Fourth edition, which would come out 1870, 1869, something like this, many years later. So this is a bit strange. So we can say, and I think one can argue, we have listened to news about the Journal des Débats, where also extracts were published, or a long article, two large pages. But I have the impression that in no other country, in no other periodical, was there such a long extract of Memory of Solferino as in All the Year Round. As I say, in my estimation, about one-third of the book was printed there. So now one may say the readers of All the Year Round were, in the first instance, interested in Charles Dickens's novels. So we do not know how many people took the trouble to read the extract of Memory of Solferino. So one can say, on the one hand, this journal had a wide readership. People could read the essence of Memory of Solferino. So in a way, that obviated the need for a full English translation. On the other hand, you may say, which is the case, on the other hand, you may say, people were so enthusiastic about this book, and it was such a success, that these extracts could have led to a demand for a full translation. But that did not happen. So now there are a few questions about what was published in All the Year Round. First of all, who was the translator? We do not know. Who was the writer? Because there was some edited material. This thing was introduced. And the book is praised, and Dunant is praised. Who is the author? Now, in all the literature, it is assumed it is Charles Dickens. That is assumed. And I'm not an expert to say, yes, one can tell from the style this is Dickens. Because those people at the University in Buckingham have started the mammoth task of analyzing every issue of All the Year Round to try to find out who are the authors of the of these political, social articles in each issue. Charles Dickens died in 1870. The journal was continued by his son, also called Charles Dickens, until maybe 1890. And there are something like 3,000 articles which are now being investigated year by year. And unfortunately for me, for us, they have not yet reached 1863. But I have now been in touch with some leading Dickens experts who are working in this project. And they seem to say this is not Charles Dickens, you know, because he was too busy, not only with writing, but as you know, he went around the country and gave performances and this exhausted him and so on. No, he would not have spent time doing this. And we do not quite know in terms of to what extent was Charles Dickens really keeping an eye on what was published. Because the magazine says, conducted by Charles Dickens. The magazine is conducted, edited. But to what extent Dickens really controlled what went into the magazine, we do not know. But there is one little bit which intrigues me, which is, I forget now whether this is in the first extract, the first article, the longer one of May 1863, or the one which was published, I think, in August, which is just one page, as I mentioned before, which is an update. And there it says, we are hoping that somehow, I think maybe it is in the first one, we are hoping that the publication of these extracts of Dunant in our journal will make a real difference and will help to take forward what the Dunant was suggesting. And then I'm thinking, for such an explicit kind of recommendation and wish and so on, maybe this needed the say-so, the approval of the editor of Charles Dickens. I do not know. So the people I have been in touch with recently are speculating who might have written this article. And Dickens had a whole team of writers. And somebody is a very interesting person who was a person who wrote about medical issues and about war. And they all had good pens and so on. So as I say, we may have to be patient for a little while longer before we know who was the author. And as I say, it seems that it was not quite Dickens. I would like to finish by just saying this. When I started looking at this, and the more I have been looking at this issue in the last several months, the more there are uncertainties, the more there are questions, the more the treatment of this issue in the literature and by biographers is a mess. And when I asked the question after the presentation by Véronique Arouel, what about Victor Hugo? My source was a rather recent book on Dunant and the origins of the Red Cross by a British historian who lives in Geneva and who apparently has been working for the Red Cross and making translations. And I wonder whether I can find her quickly. She's called Angela Bennett. Oh yes, here it is. The Geneva Convention, The Hidden Origins of the Red Cross, published in Britain in 2005. And she is described as a Red Cross, a specialist in Red Cross history. And this is what she says. She says, the press was unanimous in its praise when Memory of Solferino was published in Geneva, 1862. The press was unanimous in its praise and hundreds of letters and messages came pouring in, including one from Victor Hugo and another from Charles Dickens. Now, I'm not sure whether in the archives here there are those letters. And certainly it is the case in the Letters of Charles Dickens, which is an edition in 11 volumes published by Oxford University Press from 1965 till 1997. Dunant is not listed as a correspondent. And there is no copy of Dunant's book listed in the catalogue of the library of Charles Dickens. And it's very interesting, in the 1960s there was a famous exhibition in the British Museum about great books of Western civilization. And this became known as Printing and the Mind of Man, with the last edition in 1983. It's a wonderful work. Florence Nightingale is in there, and Memory of Solferino is in there. But it does mention that the first edition of Memory of Solferino, in French, the copy had to come from I think, the university in Bâle. So apparently no copy could be found in any great public library in Britain. And I have not yet managed to contact the Florence Nightingale Museum or the Florence Nightingale Library to find out, because we know that they do not send the copy to Florence Nightingale, where is it? So as I say, there are many, I think, uncertainties, many questions, a mythology, I think, about Charles Dickens. And I think all of this came to a head, I think, in 1959, when a short article, 100 years after Solferino, when a short article was published in the monthly review of the British Red Cross. And it suggested very much that the extracts published in Charles Dickens' journal were written by Charles Dickens. And they had a little extract in this 1959 journal of the British Red Cross, and they had somehow added Charles Dickens' signature. So to make it obvious. This article was reported on in the International Review of the Red Cross a few months later. And now the title is Charles Dickens, author of... So, the endorsement of the International Committee of the Red Cross, the endorsement in Britain of the British Red Cross Society, those extracts were written by Charles Dickens. All speculation. All speculation. So as I say, in years to come, hopefully those Dickens scholars may give us the truth. To what extent was Dickens involved in the publication of these extracts? And I feared for a moment when I heard very recently that as part of these celebrations there would be this double facsimile edition, that Roger Durand somehow would have addressed all those issues about the English edition and the mystery. Why has it taken so long? But luckily that was not the case. So I think I've talked long enough. Thank you very much.
Thanks a lot, Peter. Please stay with us. So you have opened the door for a new PhD, new study, new colloquium, travel to UK, and so many things and new questions. I'm wondering, before we go to the break, if there is someone who would like to share some information or question. Yes,
yes,
please.
It's not quite England. It concerns America. So you said if nobody knew about the book in England, do you know by any chance how it was in America? If there were any articles in the press or not?
I'm afraid I have confined myself in the first instance to England,
and even
that I have not done properly, because I have not had the time to investigate the Times, the main newspapers, and so on before we come to America.
Yes.
So I'm afraid that that would be a different chapter which I have not managed to. But it is interesting that the edition we have, the full text, comes out of America.
It sounds we have the response.
I will speak about that tomorrow.
Okay. Uh-huh. Okay. Okay, that's good. Okay, thank you. Thank you very much. I think time has come for...